everybody. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where we talk about writing and life. Because what it takes to write the book you want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you want to lead. That's true. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org, and we are funded by the good people at the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. If you want to learn more about the PNWA, just go on over to pnwa.org. That's right. So we had a great guest on, Claire Haywood, who is started out as a scholar, but left, decided not to pursue an academic career, became a novelist instead. She wrote Daughters of Sparta. It's a national bestseller, and she's got a new book out, drops today. Today, people, The Shadow of Perseus, very interesting woman. I love the stories of people who move from, I have nothing against academia, really, although I sometimes sound like I do, but I don't. But it's a very different way of writing, a different way of thinking, and she's translated some really compelling stories, and she was a cool woman. So I'm glad I got to meet her, and I got to have that conversation. Like I said, she is a scholar of the ancient world with a bachelor's degree in classical civilization and a master's degree in ancient visual and material culture from the University of Warwick. Her first novel, Daughters of Sparta, was a national bestseller. Latest novel, Shadow of Perseus. And here is my fabulous conversation with her. Enjoy. All right. Look, it's Claire Haywood. Claire, how are you doing?
I'm very well, Bill. Thank you.
Yeah. So we're speaking about 6 days before The Shadow of Perseus drops in the UK and in... It's Perseus, right?
Perseus, yeah.
Okay, I suddenly had a crisis of confidence there in my pronunciation. All right, that drops. The Shadow of Perseus drops on the 21st, just as this podcast is going. And so this is novel number two. Yeah. How you feeling? It's coming up. How do you feel as that day rolls closer?
It's been a long time coming, as with most publications, really.
Yeah.
I can't think exactly how long ago it was I finished it, but I think it was at least a year ago. And it's been a slow process leading up to it. But genuinely, I'm excited for it to come out. Put a lot of work into this one.
Yeah.
And I just want to see how it goes down and what people think about it.
Yeah. You know, Claire, if I had to guess, I'm going to say you put a lot of work into whatever you do. You strike me as the sort of person who maybe is that way. Is that fair?
You're pretty spot on, yeah. that is a large part of my personality, I would say.
That's all right. You know what? Sometimes they're called workaholics. Sometimes they're called perfectionists. And maybe, but there's also a pleasure in giving something your full attention and really giving it your full effort. I think there's a pleasure in that, don't you? You got it, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not really sure where the drive comes from, but from a young age, that's how I've always been,
Yeah.
I really struggle to do things by half. So, yeah.
Yeah. Good. Don't bother. All or nothing. Yeah. All right. So, like I said, this is novel number two, Shadow Perseus. And it's not a series, but your first book was The Women of Sparta. And so you're looking at ancient Greece and the myths and stories and times, but told from a different perspective. Come to that. But your interest in the classics in that era predates these novels. You are by trade, your day job, I don't know if it still is a classics historian.
Yeah, I would say it's my educational background, at least.
Okay.
I studied classics at university and got a master's degree as well. So I spent, a good few years doing that in an academic setting. But then when it came to further study and PhD, I decided to turn away from that path. But I still remained within classics to some extent. I became a tour guide for a while at an ancient Roman site.
You just did?
So that I could still be involved in the ancient world and kind of spread my enthusiasm and continue researching and learning about, that period. And then luckily my writing took off. So I've been able to stay in that world, although in a less official academic capacity.
But you know what? What you're doing now, Claire, you're bringing it to the people.
You're bringing it to the people. And I'm joking a little bit, but in truth, sometimes it's the stories like this that really you reach an audience that never would have thought they were interested in that time and place.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I see that as a large part of the reason that I write these stories.
Yeah.
Especially, although I am a classicist by training and I did that at university, before that stage of my life, I hadn't had a formal introduction to classics and I hadn't had an educational background that allowed me to study classics. I don't know what it's like in the US so much, but in the UK, that tends to be more limited to private education. So that was something that I hadn't had access to. So really, my only introduction to classics as a younger person was through, you know, popular media, films,
right,
and books and things. So I kind of see what I'm doing now as contributing to other people being able to access these stories in other ways.
So what got, because my, actually one of my good friends studied the classics in college, and I was one of his, before he became a lawyer. So I don't know, you study the classics to become something else sometimes, but what drew you to that? Because, you know, it was a long time ago. Hey, what does it matter to me now? I'm on Twitter and Tinder or whatever. I mean, what, how does the classics, why did it resonate with you as a young person?
It's difficult to say. I mean, as a lot of people do, I mean, I was interested in the myths, first of all, when I was a child. You know, a lot of people read Greek myths and they're just exciting stories and adventures, and it's very easy to get in that way. But I think I was also a kind of natural linguist. As I say, at school, I didn't really study ancient languages, but I did study French to a fairly high level. And I really enjoyed the process of learning a language for you know, actual use in the real world, but also as a kind of academic exercise and a bit of a puzzle to put together. I love, you know, the origins of words in English. I'm obsessed with the English language as well. So I think that was a natural progression for me. I really wanted to learn Latin and ancient Greek as a kind of linguistic interest. But then aside from that, it's such a broad subject to be able to study, because my degree was quite wide. It wasn't just languages and literature.
Right.
I also got to do kind of other aspects of culture, art and archaeology, history, of course, and philosophy. And I think I've just got quite a broad interest in humanity. So it was a course where I could study all those different aspects of a civilization without having to specify literature or history or philosophy.
You know what it reminds me of? Just thinking about it, because I was thinking about the classics and that era, you know, Rome and Greece, that and Persia, I guess, also, but we tend to focus on in the West more Rome and Greece. And it reminds me a little bit, I know it's going to sound weird, but follow me if you can, high school in this way, because it's like we're all, when we're in, or what we call, I don't know what they call it, high school in Britain or not, but, you know, ages up until 17 or so, you know, that era when you're an adult physically, but mentally you're not, and you're all kind of in, you've not begun a career yet. And it struck me as like the world was so forming at that point. I mean, what we were going to become was just in its sort of really kind of its baby bird form, although there were full empires and wars being fought. But we were so still coming out of kind of the darkness of pre-civilization, pre-literate. You know, I think, right? I mean, I remember, I think Socrates complained about writing. He said, no one's going to talk anymore now that we can do that. So, and so there's a kind of fascination with us in our little baby form. Does that resonate at all?
I think that is one of the huge factors that draws people to the classics, because you can start to identify those roots of our current civilization thousands of years ago. And it's interesting both in the ways that those things have changed, you know, we see how they began and then developed over time and, you know, might have become radically different, but also the ways that they've kind of stayed the same. I mean, more so, I would say probably with the Romans, but, you know, also with the Greeks, there are aspects of culture where you're reading a, you know, an ancient tragedy or something, and you just see this spark of humanity that's barely changed at all. You know, that's one of the things that really compels me, I would say.
Yeah. So, okay. So you're, let me just see. So you get your master's in the classics. Do you get a PhD, or do you say enough?
It was definitely a route that I was exploring and considered seriously. But I didn't take that option. I mean, partly as we were saying about, you know, novels being, bringing classics to the people, you know, to me, I think further academia felt a little bit like an ivory tower. That's not
Yeah.
to denigrate the work that
No,
academics do,
no.
and I absolutely appreciate it and I use it all the time, but I think just for me personally, it would have felt a little bit insular, and for too small and too niche an audience, basically.
Were you writing secretly fiction creatively while you were doing all this nitty gritty academic? Because I'll tell you, academic writing,
Yeah.
it's not for the faint of heart. It certainly it's a different approach to the English language, I will say.
Absolutely. I mean, I found that I actually got on very well with academic writing,
Yeah,
and it
yeah.
was something that came quite naturally to me, and I enjoyed doing all the research and everything. And while I was doing those years of study, I didn't write creatively at all.
No? Wow.
As I said, I don't do things by half. So I was
Right.
100% committed to the academic life, and I really sunk my teeth into it. And I, put my life on hold to just study for those years, basically.
Right.
And then it was after I'd done my master's and I decided not to do the PhD that I thought now is my opportunity to. Well, to revisit writing because I had done it as a younger person, and to commit in the same way, 100% to trying to write a novel, essentially, and
Yeah.
that's what I did.
And so was so the, your first published novel is The Women of Sparta. Was that the first novel you started, or were there a few other babies, few aborted efforts before
There were, but
that?
it was very much teen writer stage,
Oh,
it was kind
really?
of,
Okay.
the beginnings of fantasy novels and things like that,
Sure.
but no, nothing very substantial. I mean, I'd kind of just written like short stories for fun and stuff like that, but no, no, nothing on the scale of trying to actually write my first novel.
So when you
That
sat down to
was.
write, so the first book that you sat down as an adult to seriously write was The Women of Sparta.
Yeah, Daughters of Sparta, yeah.
The Daughters, excuse me, The Daughters of
Yeah,
Sparta.
that's fine.
Wow. Hey, pretty good. So, and had you been roaming around, so there you are, you're giving people tours, you're reading out the classics, and in your mind you thought, Sparta, interesting. But there was more than one type of person living in Sparta, but we only ever hear about one for the most part. When I think of Sparta, I think about a bunch
Yeah.
of half-naked men shaking their spears at each other. And so when did you think, I think we got to tell another side of this? When did that start bubbling around?
I mean, what you just said was actually one of my fears when the first book was coming out, the fact that it's called Daughters of Sparta. I thought, having Sparta in the title, people are immediately going to think of that macho Sparta,
Yeah,
because that is
yeah.
the version that we see in popular media and in academia as well. That is the
Sure.
side that is focused on. But really, I mean, although the book is half set in Sparta, it's not about Spartan culture, I wouldn't say. Only because when we say Spartan culture, really we mean in the classical era, at the
Right.
same time that they're vying with classical Athens.
Yeah.
And this book was actually set in the Bronze Age, so quite a few centuries prior to that culture
Right.
that
I got to
we
learn my.
associate with Sparta.
Gotcha. Okay, so this is pre the sort of the classic conflict that we've come to know and love. Sort of.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. And so, all right. So you write that and you publish it. Oh my goodness! And it does all right. I mean, it does better than all right. It's and let me ask you this. It's hard. You're a little modest, maybe in your I don't know. Maybe in your private moments, not so much. But when it did start doing well, were you surprised, delighted? Did you think, yeah, I wrote a great book. Of course it's doing well.
I think so much of that side of things just feels out of your control. So you're just
Yeah.
praying that it happens. I can
Yeah.
control the book that I've written, but beyond that,
Yeah.
you just feel like you're on a roller coaster. I mean, I was elated when I even just got the publishing deal for the
Sure.
US, because it suddenly felt so much more international and it's reaching
Yeah.
this wider audience. And obviously the fact that it sold so well
Yeah.
was surprising and amazing. And I was very grateful for
Was
having
that
that platform.
pre-COVID or during COVID?
It was during COVID, yeah. Um, I
Okay.
I I got my original UK publisher's deal, literally like 3 months before COVID happened, or
Right.
before
Yeah.
lockdowns happened.
Yeah.
So then that was all going on, very much during the height of COVID. And the
Yeah.
American deal, I think, came through once all the lockdown stuff had already started. So it was a strange thing to be dealing with during a global pandemic, because I mean, selfishly,
you were doing
my
great.
Dreams were coming true. So,
hey, and you know what? I talked to another author about that. She felt so bad. I'm like, look, man, don't feel bad, because we don't all have to actually. If you're suffering, do you really want everyone else to suffer? Really? No, you don't.
Yeah,
of course not. But yeah. Also, I'm impressed. So I published a book during lockdown. The kind of books I write tend to be more personal growth, and they really depend upon me being there with the people, which I really couldn't do. It was a bit of kind of disappointing, because I just couldn't. I had to do Zoom stuff, but I'm sure you did some Zoom stuff, but it wasn't this kind of book apparently didn't need you touring bookstores to help get the word out. Did you do social media at all?
Yes. I mean, I'm a little bit of a Luddite, I will admit. I'm not. I mean, I would. That's maybe a bit strong, but I'm not. I'm not very into technology and social media. But I think that it's a very interesting, cultural thing, and I have adopted it. And I use the platforms as an author. To be honest, I probably hadn't anticipated how important it would become because of the pandemic and lockdowns and everything. I wasn't able to, see much of my book in the real world, but I was getting all these updates on Instagram and stuff. And actually that was a really valuable part of the experience to me in the end. So I'm glad that I did kind of dip my toe into that.
There are people who, there's a thing called BookTok, where people are just doing a lot of stuff on BookTok. I think it's not every kind of writer thrives in that, but there's certain kind of stories where particularly, but I do think a book in the end sells because people like it and tell their friends about it. I mean, I just think it's the way a book really spreads around. If someone says this, you got to check this out. So, okay. So it does well. And so it's telling a story about a time and place from a different point of view. And now, but that was more like obviously it's fiction, but you were basing it more not on mythological Sparta, but more on what do we know about Sparta during the Bronze Age? It's probably pretty dodgy, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. Our knowledge of Bronze Age Greece, on the whole is very patchy. And even more so for Sparta, really, there's not a lot to go on.
Okay.
So yeah, it was a process of learning about as much as I could about the culture of that time period, and then applying that to Sparta, but I couldn't do so in a very, specific way.
Right.
I'm sure that there were various variations across regions, but we just don't have enough evidence to be able to, pin those down.
Right.
But I did a lot of generalized research about Mycenaean Greece is how we refer to it, and that's basically the culture of Mycenae, which at the time seems to have been the cultural hub, so understanding that culture and then applying it across the rest of the region basically.
Right.
But yeah, it was very much rooted in a historical setting that I tried to recreate, but then also bringing in a lot of mythology and literature, I suppose, classical literature,
right,
as an inspiration and as something to kind of bounce off and respond to.
But so then for those, Shadow of Perseus is based on myth of Perseus, which, if you're not up on your Greek myths, is the dude who cut off Medusa's head. He did a lot besides it, but that's what he is perhaps best known for. Goes into the the maze. Is he also, I really don't know. Is he the maze who had to deal with also the Minotaur? No,
that's Theseus. They've got similar names. But
Thank you for helping me. Okay. So anyway, so you take it. Say no. We're gonna. So you want to also tell that from the women sort of surrounding Perseus, including. I mean, if I understand correctly, this story started for you when you got interested in Medusa herself.
Yeah,
the Medusa. Medusa. So talk to me about that.
Well, I mean, as you say, she is the most famous part of Perseus's story. In our modern cultural understanding of the story, but also, in the ancient period, she was treated more so than the rest of the characters. That part of the story seems to have been quite compelling for people.
Yeah.
So that is where it started. Because I'd kind of had, before I wrote Daughters of Sparta, even, I had an idea about a short story about Medusa, just as an interesting thing to think about, just because she's, that kind of character that I think attracts a lot of reflection and different, opinions about. But so I kind of started at that point. But then when I was reading the the whole kind of corpus of the myth and all the different literary sources that I could get my hands on, I realized actually there's these two other women that are just as pivotal to that story and potentially just as interesting, but most people wouldn't even know the names of or be able to tell you very much about them. So I decided to expand it into this a larger scale narrative that covered all three women and from their perspectives, but managing to tie it into one story that kind of covered the arcing myth of Perseus.
Right. And so, I mean, here's the thing that's interesting about that. So that's an idea, like, oh, that would be interesting. Mm-hmm. But, you know, writing is such an interest to me, a somewhat mysterious pursuit, because until you actually start doing the thing, you don't know if you actually have anything, A, that's interesting or that you're interested in. You know, mm-hmm. something can seem interesting to you in theory, mm-hmm. and then you start writing it and you go, eh. But obviously, once you got into it, you were like, yeah, this is about as cool as I thought it might be. Yeah, is that fair? Is that kind of how it went?
And I agree that you don't know when you're setting out. And a lot of it comes out in the writing. You can think, well, this seems like a good structure, and in theory, you know, it should work out. But a lot of it comes out through the actual writing process.
Yeah.
And you know, even though I had already, well, I had the myth to guide me anyway, and I had already sort of pre-imagined how I was going to play with the myth. But even so, as you're writing, you're fixing problems and parts of the narrative that just don't quite feel right or don't feel like they're going to have enough payoff. And, you know, you just have to do that work as you go along.
Yeah. And the nature of myth is it paints with broad brushstrokes. I mean, that's sort of the pleasure of it, I think. But novels do not paint with such broad brushstrokes. And particularly, you're getting characters who might have just gotten a little dot on the canvas, right? And you're fleshing them out. And so you get to get into, even though you're dealing with a myth, you have to treat it as realism in order for it to come to life, to get deeper into it. And so you had to look at the myth, you had to really make it your own story, right? I mean, it's everyone's story, but now it becomes your own. Is that kind of that how you went about it?
And I think that realism is the word that is my approach to writing. I mean, it's not the only way to approach myth retelling. Some people, you know, make it essentially a fantasy novel.
Right.
But my interest is in historical realism and what that says about societies in the past and societies in the present and, you know, the way that those structures impact the story that's being told. You know, the culture can't be separated from the story is the way that I see it, which is why I do so much research to try and understand the setting that I'm building. That very much informs how these characters are living, the decisions that they make, and the options that are open to them.
That's so interesting, because when I teach a lot of memoir writing, and that's kind of what I do, and one of the things I remind my students is, in order to tell a story about yourself from the past, you have to remember what you believed at the time you were living something, because your beliefs always influence the decisions you make. And sometimes you have to remember, and it's almost like its own culture. In other words, what I thought about life and success and everything when I was 25 was like I created my own culture in my mind, and I was sort of driven by it. So it's sort of the same thing, that our we aren't complete slaves to our environment, but how can we not be responding to, and you have to know what that actual belief system was, really what and divorce yourself from the present self who knows what she knows, don't you? I mean, you have to kind of go back there without any presumptions a little bit.
Yeah, and especially, I mean, as we've said, the period that I'm writing in, we don't have full knowledge of, and there is quite limited material in terms of archaeology and written evidence. So it becomes a puzzle to me, you know, finding the pieces of evidence that are available and trying to put that together into some sort of culture. But the thing that we're lacking the most really is, you know, the way that people thought, you know, the opinions that they had. We might know, you know, what kind of
there was no YouTube
or no, exactly.
There was no YouTube, no podcasts. I don't understand.
At least with later periods, like the Romans, for example, we have lots of things like personal letters and diaries and things like that, you know. But this period, there is absolutely nothing of that kind of material. So in terms of reconstructing people's thought processes and their relationships to one another, it's a lot more fragmented, and there has to be a lot of guesswork involved. But that, I mean, that's where I come in as the writer to try and imagine those things based on what we do know, essentially.
Now, here's an interesting question. So you're interested in historical realism, but you're obviously interested in stories. You're interested in stories about women at a time when women's stories weren't real. I mean, there are myths and Greek tragedies where women play a central role, but often more about men. I guess I don't know. Maybe I'm actually not, because I didn't study that. But what, and that part your interest, right? You come from that angle, but then you write the book. What, based on your reactions from your readers, what do they like about it? Are they also interested in that, or are they interested in something a little different than you were interested in? Can you glean any of that?
It usually surprises me the amount of varied reactions that you can get from readers, because people will like completely opposite things, you know. And I do get a lot of people that enjoy the emotional realism and complexity of it, which is something that I strive for. At the same time, you get people that are disappointed because it's not fantastical enough, or, you know, it feels too real. Especially when you're writing about historical women, people are frustrated because these women, you know, don't make the decisions that they might make, or don't have the opinions that they might have, or don't have enough agency to make them seem like active characters. But really, that's one of the things that I'm writing about, obviously, to kind of look at different types of agency, and different types of strength that aren't just I'm gonna stomp around and do whatever I want to do, but to do with survival and adaptation, and, you know, just existing within a culture that is really set up against your will and your happiness. Right.
And most people wouldn't have it in mind to try to change, even consider changing everything. And most, I think, people live assuming nothing will ever change. This is how it's going to be forever. So you got to live. So that makes sense. They want to see their heroines behaving the way they would behave now, but it's not the way it probably was back then. Ah, so interesting. And so, okay, we're not really in lockdown anymore. Things are still getting better. I'm just going to just keep going with that and assume that's what happened. So are you going to go and meet the people face to face, stand there at the podium? Are you going to do it? Are you going to do it?
I have done a few small events in the UK. Okay. Obviously that's where I'm based.
Yeah.
And I do enjoy, you know, meeting readers and talking about books and, you know, the stories that I'm telling. But I also find it quite anxiety inducing. You know, I'm a bit of a nervous person.
Yeah.
And I think it's common for a lot of authors to be quite introverted and a little bit reclusive.
Yeah.
But I'm aware of not letting that overtake too much, you know. Although it's my instinct to kind of hide away a little bit. You know, I do want to reach out and to kind of be involved in the kind of literary world that I'm contributing to, you know, and to talk to people and share the enthusiasm in some restricted way.
So, you know, you're gonna show up there, they're gonna want to ask you questions, they're gonna be so interested in you. What if academia came knocking and said, you write these books, they're so interesting, you clearly know a lot about it. Yes, you don't have a PhD, but we don't care. We are interested in fame, and you're a successful writer. We want you to come lecture about that, not your books, not even creative writing, but just that era. Would you do it? Would you answer the call?
I think it's something that I would consider, because I would, you know, I would find it fulfilling, you know, intellectually, and to be able to, as I say, kind of reach out in that way. And it was a career path that I was considering anyway. Yeah. You know, one of the appeals of doing a PhD and becoming a professional academic was the lecturing side of things, not just, you know, being shut away in my office doing research. I like communicating. I just find it stressful. That is the tricky thing. It's a dichotomy for me. But, you know, I have a sort of will to it, but at the same time, it scares me.
Yeah. Jerry Seinfeld.
I try to take opportunities, but
good. Keep doing it. Jerry Seinfeld, the comedian, had a very funny joke about the number one fear for most people is public speaking in public, and that is more than dying. He said that means at the funeral, you'd rather be the one in the box than giving the eulogy in general. So you're not alone. You're not alone. A lot of people worry. Okay, listen, I hope you have lots of opportunities to overcome that fear, and people are just begging you to come talk. But so best of luck. For those listeners, it drops today. Shadow of Perseus. Go get it, people. Go get it. It's where all fine books are sold. I'm not quite done with you yet, though. Not quite done with you, Claire. So here you go. You've written book two. I know you're working on another book. I can just feel it. I think you got another one in there. But I want you to think about all the writing you've done, even the academic writing, which I'll call writing, even that academic stuff. And if it's taught you anything, it's taught you what?
I think most of all, it's taught me things about myself, which isn't some kind of grand wisdom that I can necessarily pass on to other people. But there are a few things as solitary as sitting down and writing a novel, I think.
Yeah.
So you spend a lot of time in your own brain and kind of testing your own capabilities and sort of your limits, but also your potential. Sometimes you surprise yourself. And I think it's kind of taught me things about the way that my brain works, because I think previously I always thought I was a very kind of rational person. As I said, I got on well with academia and research, and I'm very good at, you know, tackling things sensibly and, you know, having a plan and whatever. But when you're actually in the process of writing, I find that a lot of it is very intuitive in a way that surprises me. And it just kind of comes out from somewhere that I don't fully understand with my rational brain. You know, it's not a fully active process. There's something else going on there, which I always find strange and interesting and surprising.
Well, you're speaking my language now. To all your listeners, your rational mind, almost useless to you in terms of creative writing of any kind. It just isn't going to help. There's something else far more useful called your intuition. I totally agree. Claire, you're awesome. Congratulations on the book. I wish you nothing but success with it.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
See? Intuitive. That's right. You know, you can't really, there's not much place for intuition in the halls of scholarship. Maybe there is. There's room for it everywhere, but you need it when you write. Ooh, boy, you need it. It's your best guide. Listen, I want to thank my producer, RJ Jeffries. Thank you, my friend. To all of you out there, trust your intuition. Trust it. It's really your best. It just is. It's speaks to you in a language only you understand. You might as well listen to it. And the thing it'll tell you, will tell you when you like something. Yes, it will. So why not listen to it and go find something you like to do, something you love to do, and do it.